From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of a priest, a nun, and their son. We talk with Peter Manso about his new memoir, Vows, which tells the story of his parents, and we'll talk with his parents. His mother, Mary, is a former nun. His father, Bill, refused to resign when he married Mary. He feels called by God to serve as a married priest and thinks it's time for the church to allow priests to marry. Now Bill Manso's status in the church is priest under penalty of censure. Also, we talk with Barbara Ehrenreich about her latest book, Bait and Switch, a look at white-collar unemployment. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers DVDs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As improbable as it may seem, Peter Manso is the son of a priest, Bill Manso, and a former nun, Mary Manso. You're probably wondering how Bill can be a priest if he's married. Well, the church wanted Bill to resign when he got married, but he says renouncing his vows would have been an acknowledgement that he was unfit for the priesthood and had made a mistake in seeking ordination. And he didn't believe he'd made a mistake. Bill Manso thinks it's time for the church to allow priests to marry. But the first synod of bishops under Pope Benedict, which ended its meetings on Saturday, decided not to change its celibacy rules. Peter Manso has written a new memoir called Vows about his parents and how their religious lives affected his life. Peter is also the founding editor of the online publication about religion called KillingTheBuddha.com. We'll hear from Peter Manso a little later in the show, after we hear from his parents. Bill Manso was excommunicated when he got married. Then, as a result of a change in church rules, his official status became priest under penalty of censure. Bill Manso, could you describe in your words why you refused to leave the priesthood when you got married?
Well, because I believed that I had a vocation from God to be a married Catholic priest. I was ordained in 1961, and in the course of my ministry of 8 years, I had come to believe that that in order for priests to really have an effective ministry, most priests should have a participation in the kind of life that the average person lived, which was to be married and have children, and to live life as the ordinary person lived it, not in an excluded solitary fashion, which is what the celibate ministry calls for.
What led you to the conclusion that priests should not be living a life outside of the culture surrounding them, and that they should have the chance to marry as well? Did you feel that way before you became a priest, or did you reach that conclusion after becoming one?
Actually, it was a gradual transformation of consciousness for me as a result of my academic studies while in the seminary, and then following my ordination, I became involved with a Roman Catholic lay apostolic community in which the leadership were married men, and most of the people who were part of the community were married people, and as far as I could see, that they were living lives every bit as ministerial as the priests and the rectories around me. And when I looked at the New Testament, they appeared to be living lives more in conformity with the gospel as it was lived out in the second vet. As it was lived out in the Acts of the Apostles, than the church around me.
What does it mean to you to remain a priest, even though you can't practice and even though the church doesn't recognize you as a priest?
Well, first, Terry, the church does recognize me as a priest. My classification as a priest is a priest under suspension. That's the penalty that I have because I have married without permission of the Vatican, and I'm simply one of 100,000 men throughout the world, Roman Catholic priests, who have married in the last 30 years. Here in the United States, I'm one of about 25,000 married Roman Catholic priests, so I definitely am not a solitary person in this endeavor.
So what does it mean to you to be a priest, even though you can't practice, so to speak, within the church? You know, practice being a priest.
Well, actually, one of the models that I have for what I do, the way I go at life, is the worker priest in France. And that was a mission of the Roman Catholic Church in France during the 40s and the 50s, in which priests actually worked in factories, and in order to forge better bonds with the average layperson and to understand the conditions in which the average layperson lived. So I see myself as a pioneer worker priest following the model of the these priests in France in the 40s and the 50s.
Mary Manso, how did you meet your husband?
Well, I had been in the Sisters of St. Joseph for about 10 years, and that's a community that really served the Archdiocese of Boston and a couple of mission areas. And my last assignment was in the city in Roxbury. And I think my experience there had sort of broadened my view of the world and of the kinds of things that I wanted to do. And when it came time to think about, well, am I going to be able to stay in the city or will I have to leave and go back to some other convent? You know, will my assignment change? Because we didn't have control over that. I began to think about that, and I felt that I would rather not do that, that I would step out of the community and then see where life brought me. I did meet Bill. He had a storefront center, Catholic Messengers of the Bible, down on Chaumont Ave in Roxbury, and he was stationed in another parish in Roxbury, and I did meet him there at an evening Bible session or just in an afternoon when people would come into the center for some support and a place to sit down and things like that. So I did meet Bill. I didn't have any intention of marrying Bill when I met him, or even when I was still in the convent. When I left the convent, I didn't know up to a certain point, just before I left the convent, I really didn't know that Bill had been considering making a move from, you know, from the priesthood to his vision of priesthood. It was only after we started going out and those kinds of things developed.
Mary Mansa, why did you decide to leave your religious order and stop being a nun?
Well, of course, those days in the late 60s, there was a lot of turmoil. There was a lot of change that was happening in people's thinking, especially after Vatican II. And a lot of the sisters in the community were reaching out to do other ministries. We were basically teachers. We taught in the parochial schools of Boston, but many of the sisters were looking at other areas where they could minister, and they wanted to be able to do that more out in the world, so to speak. Some of them wanted to go and live in apartments in the parishes, and in the early days of the, you know, maybe around 66, 67, 68 or so, those permissions were not granted, and some of those sisters then decided to leave, and they formed their own little communities with the support of a pastor in other parishes, especially in the city. So those sisters were leaving the very convent that I was also in, and I had an opportunity to go to do that with them, but decided that I would just assume I would go home and see what, you know, life would bring to me by doing that. And I think it was basically just that my mind had opened up a little bit more. I had different experiences in the city, became more aware of the needs of people in the city. We had more contact in the city with just the regular people that lived around us, more so than we did in some of the other parish schools.
My guests are Mary and Bill Manso. Their son Peter has written a new memoir called Vows, the Story of a Priest, a Nun, and Their Son. We'll hear from Peter later in the show. This is Fresh Air. Peter Manso's new book, Vows, is about his parents' religious and married lives. His mother, Mary, is a former nun. His father, Bill, is a priest who refused to resign when he married. The book also reveals that both Bill and Mary were sexually abused by their church mentors. Now, it turns out, Bill and Mary Manso, that you've both had some history of being abused in your background, and Bill, you might think the word abuse is perhaps a little too strong. I don't know what word you'd like to use, but would you tell us briefly what happened between you and the priest who was your mentor when you were an altar boy?
Well, Terry, I think that the word abuse is probably not too strong because what happened to me initiated me into something I had no anticipation of. And that was that I was 15, 15, 16 years old, when I was befriended by a local, my local parish priest, who was a really wonderful man. And the priest asked me to begin driving for him because he had high blood pressure, and it was a way of helping him. So I agreed to that, and so I grew close to him. And at the end of an evening, say when I had driven him someplace, we were, this particular evening, we were sitting in his car in front of my parents' home, and he put his arm around me and held my hand, and then he kissed me, and he kissed me on the lips. And this was something that I certainly had not anticipated, and I really didn't know what to do with it, except that I recognized that he was showing me affection, and I certainly had a feeling of affection for him. But it was a disturbing experience, and it was not simply that one time, but that it continued. And I found out later on that my father had looked out the window and saw us sitting in the car, and remonstrated with my mother that I should be coming in the house. And my mother said, "No, never mind. You know, he's okay. He's with the priest." And to this day, I have a regret that my mother suggested that to my father. And what it did to me was it raised within me subsequently a fear that I might be homosexual, and it was something that I had to deal with for years afterwards in terms of my own interior life.
Did you ever talk to the priest about this after the fact?
No, I did not. As it turned out, he became quite ill with his hypertension and was confined to first to the hospital, then to his home. And in point of fact, he died the day I went into the seminary. I was 17 years old.
And he was the person most responsible for getting you into the seminary. He's the one who encouraged you to do it. What's your reaction now, knowing that it wasn't only this priest, but so many priests who had abusive, inappropriate relationships with altar boys and other young boys in the church, and that nothing was done about it, that some of these priests were just moved from one parish to another, while at the same time it's considered absolutely wrong and inappropriate and impossible for a priest to be married and continue to function actively in that role in the church.
Right. There's a great deal of distortion and deception within the Roman Catholic Church, at least there was, and the reason for it was to protect the reputation of the institution. And in point of fact, I went with this priest once to the home of a young girl. I drove him there, and he went in and talked with the she was a young woman. She was probably in her late teens, I would think, and she had been impregnated by another priest. And he went, and so the priest that I was with went there to talk the family into keeping quiet and for the young woman to have her baby and put her up for adoption, that sort of thing. So these things were always dealt with quietly and secretly. And that is part of the problematic, and that's one of the reasons why I have chosen to live as I have publicly as a married Catholic priest, is to engender a public discussion about these issues so that people will be able to rectify this fundamental problem.
Mary Manso, you were abused repeatedly by a priest who had taken you under his wing and then some. Tell us a little bit about what happened to you.
Well, basically, I was a senior in high school. I was 16, would be turning 17 in the spring. And I was very close with some of the sisters, one in particular, and they were a different community than the one I finally entered. But I had decided, as some of my other friends did, to go to that community. It was in Halifax. And so my mind had been made up to do that. And then this priest came to the parish in the late winter of 58 and just started, you know, paying more attention to me than to a lot of the other kids. I was very involved in the CYO. Like Bill, we had dances, and in the summertime we would go to the beaches, and he would take kids, you know, here and there around the city. And and so during those times, there was sort of this hidden sexual abuse going on, hidden from the others. And then at other times, he would take me down to the Cape and things like that. And it was a very alarming time in the sense that that it kept going on, and I don't even think I felt anything. I think I was just in this haze. And I don't even know at that time that I would think to have called it abuse, except that it was always something that I did and something that I was ashamed of.
Well, he not only touched you inappropriately, you were worried you were pregnant.
Yes, and I think that comes out of an incident when he took me down to the Cape, and I have the memory of going into a cottage and the memory of him coming near me and telling me that, oh, there's a bed in the other room. And the only other memory I have is that we were leaving. I'm not saying I have repressed memory or you know, and I don't really remember what happened. Maybe nothing happened. But through that whole experience, my own, I suppose, lack of knowledge and education, pregnancy things and intercourse and things were kind of vague to me in those days. And so I did have that fear because I wasn't quite sure how things happened, which sounds kind of silly now, but that's the way it was in a girls' high school, at least for me.
What was it like for you to be a nun, having taken a vow of chastity and supposedly being a virgin, knowing that whether you actually had intercourse with this priest or not, you felt violated by him? You felt impure, and you're supposed to be, you know, in a quote, pure state when you're becoming a nun.
Yeah. Well, I think probably my biggest fear was my own perception that, oh, some of these nuns who were in charge of us, like novice mistress and people like that, they knew. Somehow they knew that something had happened, you know. That was always something that was more in my mind. I mean, certainly I was always very guilty and that type of thing. And I never shared it with anybody, and not until, like, 1995. And
not even with your husband?
No, I never told Bill until after I had confronted that priest in, I think it was 1995.
I'm just curious, you know, so many people have made the case that the church should not allow homosexual priests because homosexuality in the priesthood leads to the kind of sexual abuse against boys that we've seen. You were a woman sexually abused by a heterosexual priest. Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure about his orientation, only because of a remark that he made when he called the diocese himself and was very angry and told them that he should have just killed me. He had a notorious reputation for having a gun and being homicidal, which I found out years later. But I don't believe that all the troubles in the church come because some priests may be homosexuals. When the boys are mistreated and they're young, they're pedophiles. And a homosexual person, they can have relationships, but they're adult relationships. But there are many, many women, I couldn't even guess a number, who have never come forward. Some have and told their stories, but there are many more who have never come forward and talked about the abuse that they received at the hands of some priests. And I always have to throw in, I feel, because of my love for the church, and we have many good friends, that there are many, many good and dedicated priests who work very hard, who are very well-adjusted in life, and they're out there working, and it is very sad that these other men have really blackened their name.
So now that all of this is out in the open to each other and publicly as well, is it easier to put that part of your past behind you and move on?
Yes. I feel as though a big weight is off my shoulders, and now with Peter's book coming out, also, it's been something that I've been able to share with my friends, people that I'm very close to. And although when Peter was writing his book, I would say, oh, when the book comes out, I'm going into hiding. That's it. You're not going to find me around. The exact opposite has happened. And it was a real relief to sit at school with my friends and to watch and to talk about, after they read the book, to talk with them about it.
Bill Mansell, do you think there's a connection between the requirement of being celibate for priests and the amount of sexual abuse on the part of priests that we now know has happened?
Absolutely. And let me just say very quickly that celibacy as a gift from God is a gift from God. And so consequently, it's not something which can be legislated by human authority. So the requirement that priests be celibate as a mandatory law is an unjust law, and it is not something that really can be followed. And because it is forced on priests, it is a crime that cries to heaven for resolution. They only accept because they feel called by God to the priesthood, and so they want to serve, and they hope that they will be able to serve well. But they don't, in their heart of hearts, believe that they have the gift of celibacy. They believe they have the call to priesthood, but not celibacy. But they do it trying to do the best they can.
Bill and Mary Mansell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having us. We enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Terry.
Bill and Mary Manso, their son Peter has written a memoir called Vows, the story of a priest, a nun, and their son. We'll talk with Peter in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, and from Dial Trade Paperbacks, publisher of A Dictionary of Macau, a novel in dictionary format by Han Xiaogang. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Peter Manso talks about being the son of a priest and a former nun. Barbara Ehrenreich describes the futile job search she embarked on as part of her research for her latest book, Bait and Switch. It's about white-collar unemployment. And Lloyd Schwartz watches a new set of Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers DVDs. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new book, Vows, Peter Manso writes about his parents' religious lives and how they affected his life. His mother, Mary, is a former nun. His father, Bill, is a priest who refused to resign when he got married. His status is now priest under penalty of censure. Peter Manso's book also reveals that both of his parents were sexually abused by their mentors in the church. Peter, I'm assuming that you knew about the sex abuse in both of your parents' lives before you started to write this book about them?
No. In fact, I thought I had enough material with just the fact that my father had been a priest and my mother was a nun. And so that's the book that I decided to write, and it was only as I learned their stories that I learned the full story. In fact, when it first occurred to me to write about my parents, it was about 10 years ago. I was still in college, and I had to write a graduating thesis. I studied religion, so I thought, I'll tell my parents' stories. And I approached them about it, and I asked them, and at the time they said, oh, no, that doesn't sound like a good idea. And I know now it's because that was in 1996, and my mother was just beginning her court case. My father knew about it. My mother knew about it. I didn't know about it, and neither did my brother or my sister. So it was not only was it a secret in my mother's life for 40 years, it was a secret in the family for 10 years after that. It was only after I started writing the book that they decided that they would tell me, that they would share this with me.
What was your reaction?
Oh, I was surprised. I was stunned, and I was heartbroken for them. But the more I thought about it, it began to make sense. There had always been growing up some signs of depression on my mother's part, and I didn't quite understand it as a child. I don't know if a child can really understand when their parent seems that way, but I didn't understand it, and so it explained a lot to me about who my mother was and what she had been through. And also just in terms of someone who thinks and writes about the church, having seen such pervasive abuse in so many different corners all around the country, that it had not hit home in my family would have been odd if it had not. So to learn how close my family was to it made perfect sense after learning just how widespread the problem is.
A story that your mother did not have time to tell, but I'll ask you to tell, is that the priest who sexually abused her was also responsible for a major medical issue that has changed her life physically. Would you tell what happened?
Well, I only know this from my mother. This other priest has died, and there was no talking to him to hear his side of the story. But as my mother understands it, when she was being abused by this priest when she was 16, 17 years old, and she began to speak up about it and to make noises that she was going to not stand for, it was going to say something, he more and more wanted her to be on her way off to the convent. And simultaneous with that, my mother happened to come down with a toothache. And as it was then, when you would enter a religious community, they did not want you to bring your health problems in with you. So you needed to have all of that settled beforehand. One of the requirements of entering the Sisters of St. Joseph Novitiate, in fact, was a very thorough health exam. So with my mother's bad tooth, she happened to mention to this priest that she was having this problem, and it might delay her entrance into the religious community. Well, he told her to go not to her own family dentist, but to a dentist he knew, and he would take care of it for her. And this dentist, his prescription was to remove all of her top teeth. And as I understand it, she had a toothache, so it was a bit drastic, this decision. So 17 years old, my mother had all of her top teeth removed on the eve of her entrance into the convent.
What did you think of the church growing up? You know, your mother had been a nun, your father a priest.
Early on, I loved it. It was so much a part of who we were. I mean, we went to church every Sunday, but we also had church at home all the time. As I said, we grew up in this community of married priests and former nuns, and they would come over and we would have Mass. And those were our kinds of family parties. I mean, we would have Mass and then have a backyard barbecue. That's what they did for their leisure time. That's how they socialized. There was often a liturgical element to even those kinds of casual gatherings. And I loved it, and I loved church. I loved the music, and I loved the smells. Slowly, though, I started to realize that we weren't like other Catholic families. In my CCD Catholic education classes, I would learn that priests never married, for example. And if I raised my hand and tried to say that sometimes they do get married, it caused a lot of problems. I mean, we had, as a family, we had questions that the regular churchgoers couldn't answer. And when we raised them, when we mentioned these facts about our parents' lives, we would feel that there was this wrongdoing. There was a sin in our family. And so I think as a result of that, I'm moved further and further away from the church.
But eventually you thought you might have a spiritual vocation, and you entered the seminary. What was the change?
Well, I didn't enter seminary, I should say. I was studying religion as an undergraduate, and I was particularly interested in medieval Catholicism and church history. And so I spent some time in a monastery, in a Trappist monastery, and was really drawn to the life, to this all-encompassing idea of a life ordered by God, ordered by ritual. But I think that as I investigated that, I ran into a lot of the same questions and issues that my father had when he was my age or a little older. It's just there is a tension between the idea, the hope of being connected, being close to God and tradition, and it keeping you from something fundamental in life, from marriage, from family, from sex. And it just ultimately, as I grew up, I grew out of my romantic feelings and saw that you at least for now, you can't have it both ways in the Catholic Church.
You write, for all the beauty of the Abbey and the sincere efforts of the men I had met there, it rested on divisions born of the idea that this world is nothing but a waiting room.
Yes, that's what I think is really at issue with celibacy. It's a lot more than whether or not priests can marry. It has to do fundamentally with the way the church thinks about sex, the way the church thinks about the body, the way the church thinks about women. There is nothing defensible in the church's position that women cannot be ordained as priests. It is only, as far as I'm concerned, a remnant of a medieval fear of sex, of the feminine. And until the church can come to terms with that, can ask itself hard questions about where these beliefs came from and what to do about them, I don't think that even allowing priests to marry, I don't think that will be enough.
I think, is it fair to describe you now as somebody who's interested in telling stories about faith?
Yes, I think so. I think that's really how I've come to understand belief. When I was investigating it for myself, I didn't understand it. The idea of believing was what kept me separate from the monks I met, and I admired their lives. And yet they had this thing, this belief that I couldn't really penetrate because deep down I didn't share it. And so now it's become my practice of faith to learn other people's stories of how they live their own.
Do you understand your parents' abiding faith in the Roman Catholic Church, and do they understand your approach to religion?
I think so. I think so. I've been through the process of writing the book. It's sort of come together quite a bit, and I've been surprised by the response some of my parents' friends have been sending them about the book. They think it's part of the mission, and I meant to tell my parents' story. I didn't mean to contribute to the mission so much. But I can see that it is, because sometimes just telling a true story and showing it in all its complexity can do a world of good, can show what changes need to be made.
Peter Manso, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Peter Manso is the author of the new book Vows, the story of a priest, a nun, and their son. He's also the founding editor of the online publication about religion, killingthebuddha.com. You can read an excerpt of his book Vows on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Barbara Ehrenreich talks about her new book, Bait and Switch, a look at white-collar unemployment. This is Fresh Air. For journalist Barbara Ehrenreich's best-selling book, Nickel and Dimed, she went undercover, so to speak, and got a number of low-paying jobs. She worked as a server in a chain restaurant, a cleaning person, and a Walmart associate to see firsthand the difficulties of living on the wages these jobs paid. For her latest book, Bait and Switch, Ehrenreich went undercover again to understand what white-collar workers are up against after they've been downsized out of a job. And she looked at the industry that sells people in the job market makeovers, resume assistance, and employment counseling. What were the rules that you laid out for yourself for this book in looking for a job?
Okay, I wanted to get a white-collar corporate job. I faked a resume, but there was nothing in it that I couldn't actually do. I presented myself as a PR person, which is, you know, goes along with being a writer, a journalist. And so that was me. That was my persona. And my rules were that I had to do everything possible to get a job.
One of the jobs that you declined was at an insurance company. What was the job like? Why was it something you didn't even think about accepting?
Well, first I had to say I was kind of thrilled because it was the first legitimate bit of interest that popped into my inbox, you know, in, what, 9 months or something. And they said, we're really excited about your resume. We think you'll, you know, fit well in our company. And it was a sales job. And I wrote back and said, I'm not interested in sales. But however, I can manage your sales force. And they said, oh, come on over. Well, all it was in fact, sales. And you're basically, you're on your own. All you have, you're given is the right to go out and sell their product. And then you make some money off, you know, as many of these policies as you can sell. No benefits, no salary, no office even to work out of. So, but, you know, that kind of so-called job where you're really on your own making commissions, is increasing thing that people turn to, especially those people who've been ejected from the corporate world, people who have been white collar, who have, organizational skills and so forth. It's very insecure, very scary.
And the other job you were offered was similar, except it's selling cosmetics instead of selling insurance.
Yes. Now, this is what you would have to say, knowing me, objectively was not a good fit. But I was looking a little more, you know, I really transformed myself for this job search. I had makeup, you know, and so I caught the eye of a woman who was trying to recruit people. Again, you only make whatever money you can from selling the product. And in both of these cases, this kind of, annoying or scary thing is you've got to put up some money to get into it. For the cosmetics job, my calculation, I think, was I would have needed $1,900 for my initial inventory. And for the insurance job, I would have had to put out about that much for the various, you know, to get licensed and to do all these things to even get my foot in the door. So you have to make this upfront investment, and then you don't know if you're going to make any money.
Now, you're a professional writer and have been for many years. What did you learn about resume writing by actually going to a professional?
Well, my resume was fake, but I got the sense that everybody's is a little bit fake. You know, surprise. I said, I'm a little worried about my age, that I'm, that I don't want that working against me. And the coach just said, well, how would anybody know your age? I said, well, because obviously I have all this experience and it tells when I graduated from college. She said, oh, no way. You don't tell when you graduated from college. And you got to hack off, remove any experience that comes from 10 or 15 years ago max. So you've already condensed yourself into this seemingly younger person. And another strange thing about the resume writing, one coach, advised me to, she after looking at the results of my personality test, which I must say was pretty good. She thought I had a wonderful personality. She said I could now claim to have all these qualities in my resume, like takes charge easily of situations. She said that's one of my personality traits. And I said, well, so, you know. She said, so put it in your resume. I said, no, you can't do that. You know, that's just based on your test. So I thought all of that was kind of, you know, borderline dishonest.
When your process was over and you realized, you know, your time was up and you weren't getting a job, you ended up contacting some of the job seekers that you'd met at the beginning of the process to see how did they do, what kind of jobs, if any, did they find? What are some of the things that you learned about the job seekers that you met?
Well, so this is people who've been looking for many months and or over a year in some cases. And, you know, it's a pretty grim trajectory. The first thing people always talk about doing is cutting back expenses. You know, obvious things, no more cable TV, no more movies and things like that. Then they may downsize their living quarters. And then they may auction off possessions on eBay. If there was a non-working spouse in the picture, he or she gets whatever job he or she can get. And, you know, what happens if it's a single person, they often talk about going back to live with their parents. If it's a family or even a lot of single people, they take a so-called survival job. And that's what white-collar people call them. And these are just the ordinary jobs that blue-collar people have. One woman was cleaning toilets. And this was a marketing a person in information technology. One man talked about working at Circuit City. Another man was driving an airport limo. And they like to think that these jobs will be short-term. The trouble is, you know, the longer you're unemployed in the white-collar sense, the less likely you ever are to get a job. Because you can't put that in your resume, right? How do you explain the last year if you have been stocking inventory at Walmart?
Now, in order to find a job, you changed your name. I mean, Barbara Ehrenreich is a pretty well-known name right now. Nicola Dimes has been such a successful book. So you changed your name from Ehrenreich, which is the name of your first husband, to Alexander, which is your maiden name. You got a new Social Security card for your name as Barbara Alexander. Is that a change you ever would have made in your name had it not been for the book?
No, I don't think so. I thought about it when John Ehrenreich and I were divorced, but, you know, my kids had the name of Ehrenreich, and so I, you know, wanted to stay with it. I tell you, Alexander's a lot easier to spell.
So do you use it now? I mean, you actually changed it legally, so how much how much of your identity is now as Barbara Alexander, and how often do you actually use that name?
No, I still use Ehrenreich.
So does that mean...
But this was undercover, Terry. Mm-hmm. This was really undercover. When you change your name, I don't think I was totally undercover in Nickel and Dime because I was using my own name. And here I was definitely, certainly did not want to be identified. Because I'm sure some employer would have, might have read some of the things I've written and decided I had a bad attitude.
Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry.
Barbara Ehrenreich's latest book is called Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD collection of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers musicals. This is Fresh Air. Among the most beloved and popular movie musicals ever made were the 10 films that teamed Fred Astaire with Ginger Rogers. A few of them were available for a short time when DVDs first appeared, but then went out of circulation. Now Warner Brothers Home Video has released the first volume of a completely remastered set of Astaire-Rogers films, films that music critic Lord Schwartz says have been worth waiting for.
Nothing's impossible, I have found. When my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again. Don't lose your confidence.
If one function of art is to give us a deeper insight into the nature of reality, isn't it ironic that some of the greatest art seems to be so artificial? The formulaic plots and brilliant dialogue of Jane Austen or Raymond Chandler, the formal perfection of a Vermeer painting or a Mozart opera. What could be less natural than when Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, in the marvelous films they made in the 1930s, suddenly erupt into dance? Yet what feels more right? Their songs, by some of the 20th century's greatest songwriters, are often about dancing. And like opera arias, the dances lift what their characters are feeling to a higher plane, even beyond words. What could be more expressive of giving in to love than Roger's swooning backbends? What could express greater joy in life than Astaire's buoyant and dazzling footwork? Could anything represent a successful relationship better than the intricate grace of their partnership? Their feet read each other's minds.
Well, if Madge doesn't care, I certainly don't.
Neither do I. All I know is that it's heaven. I'm in heaven. And my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven.
Their dances are a sort of courtship ritual, which also includes the fun of courtship, as in such goofy numbers as Irving Berlin's I'm Putting All My Eggs in One Basket, or George and Ira Gershwin's slippery exploration of how language itself can affect a relationship. A tricky number that actually takes place on roller skates.
You say either, and I say either. You say neither, and I say neither. Either, either, neither, neither. Let's call the whole thing off. You like potato, and I like patata. You like tomato, and I like tomato. Potato, patata, tomato, tomato. Oh, let's call the whole thing off. But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we must part. And oh, if we apart, then that might break my heart. So if you like pajamas, and I like pajamas.
Some of the Astaire-Rogers dances have a more serious cast, like Berlin's Let's Face the Music and Dance from Follow the Fleet, which both encourages us to escape from the depression and the shadows of war, and also reminds us of the bleak future we're trying to avoid. Maybe their most moving dance, their darkest and most beautiful, is to the Jerome Kern Dorothy Field song Never Gonna Dance from Swing Time. If dancing represents the joy of their lives together, then their dance of parting must also be a farewell to dancing itself.
I'll put my shoes on beautiful trees. I'll give my rhythm back to the breeze. My dinner clothes may dine where they please. For all I really want is you. And two Groucho marks I give my cravat. To Harpo goes my shiny silk hat. And to heaven I give a vow to adore you. I'm starting now to be much more positive. That though I'm left without my penny, the wolf was not smart. He left me my heart, and so
I cannot go for anything but the La Belle, La perfectly swell romance. Never gonna dance, never gonna dance, only gonna love you. Never gonna dance.
One thing that makes the artifice of the musical numbers work so well is that the dances are embedded in silly comic plots that are already artificial. I'm actually very fond of these farcical situations of concealment and mistaken identity, partly because the teamwork of the supporting actors is so delightful. But these are also the perfect films for DVD, because if you're not in the mood for the story, it's easy to skip from one breathtaking musical number to the next. You can create your own orgy of great songs and dances. I can hardly wait for Volume 2.
Lord Schwartz teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the Astaire and Rogers Collection, Volume 1, on Warner Home Video. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song featuring the singer and pianist Shirley Horn. She died Thursday night at the age of 71. On Friday, we'll feature her 1992 Fresh Air performance and interview.
Hey there, cutes, put on your dancing boots. Come dance with me. Come dance with me, what an evening for some terpsichore. Handsome face, I know a swinging place. Come dance with me, romance with me on a crowded floor. And while the rhythm pings, oh, what lovely things I'll be saying. For what is dancing but making love set to music playing? When the band begins to leave the stand.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis met in the 40s, no one would have predicted that the aloof crooner and the goofy comedian would have made such a wildly popular pair. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jerry Lewis. He's written a new memoir about his partnership with Martin. Join us for the next Fresh Air.